If you can stay tuned, we're going to start an oral history of the Gilbert Theatre. Today we're going to continue our story of the Gilbert Theatre with the oral history of all 21 years and before. Our interviewer is Jason Wetzel. And Jason, what are we going to do today?
Oh, good. Hey, Glenn, it's good to be back here at Brandt's Lane. And to refresh people's memory, we're going to be talking about the history of the Gilbert. But to understand the Gilbert, you need to understand the creative genius behind the Gilbert, which was Lynn Pryor. And Lynn's early life we went over last week. This week, we're going to continue where we left off. And where we left off last week was...
I talk of my life being such a success. Well, there are times when I just barely made it through. And my military experience was one of them. But I arrived back home, and then I got out a few months early to go back to graduate school. So then I went back to Humboldt State as a fifth year to become a teacher.
When teaching what drama?
Yes. And so then I was working through that year. Then I fell in love.
And, you know, can you hold off a minute? You got to cut his mic off. Hey, you know, Glenn, that's very, very personal. How, do you, are you sure you want to talk about your love?
Yes, I think it's a universal theme that goodness knows. And it's so much a part of who we are. The people that we've loved, the people that have loved us. And yes, I do want to.
Okay, all right. Can you put the mic back on? Okay. Ready? Okay, there it is. Well, okay. Ladies and gentlemen, we left off last week. We were talking about, Lynn said, and I fell in love. Lynn, would you care to expand upon that for me?
First, I need to go back. You know, there's all kinds of love, isn't there? Now, my spiritual curriculum is called A Course in Miracles. And there we learn that there are really just two emotions, love and fear. Love gives us all, everything. Fear takes everything away from us. So love is critical to our happiness. We all know that. There's familial love. There's love of one's family, one's friends. But romantic love comes, my experience has been, not very often. First time, I was just transferred from Humboldt State University to San Francisco State University. And this is before the campus had been moved out of the city.
And this would have been what year, roughly?
In 1953. There's nothing rough about it.
Early 50s.
This is 1953. It's all embedded in my mind like a searing brand. In the fall of 1953, I was sitting in old Freddie Burke Theater in downtown San Francisco, the original home of San Francisco State, just on the eve of its transferring out further out on sand dunes. And I was sitting there for orientation in this old, dark, ugly theater. And suddenly I looked to my side, and there was sitting a young man whose name was Jim. He had seen me across the auditorium, and he told me later he just rushed over there and sat beside me. That was the very opening moments of a great love affair that lasted, sadly, for only a year. It's the kind of thing that I will always be grateful that I had as a gay man, you wonder what's going to happen. We talk for hours, Jason, about being gay in the 40s and 50s in America. You have to realize that the American Psychiatric Association just took it off the mental illness list in the early 70s. So I was one of those people that grew up feeling like something was really, really wrong with you, and you better keep it a secret if all possible. I had a gay uncle who, living in this small town, I would hear people whispering about him, and I knew that I didn't want that kind of life. But now there I am, 19 years old, sitting in this auditorium with Jim. Then began this wonderful year long, my sophomore year. He was a graduate student. And I was in a dorm, and I spent as much time as I could in his apartment. He was bright and fun, and we just spent such wonderful times at Stern Grove in San Francisco. If you know San Francisco, we were everywhere, at the beach and the Golden Gate Park, and just wonderful, wonderful year, falling in love and thinking that everything was going to go on forever. But we had no idea of knowing what was in store for us.
Let me ask you, at that time as a 19-year-old, at 1953, how open could you be, or how secretive?
Oh, well, you were just scared to death that you were going to be caught doing something. One of our first dates, we were near Lake Merced, kissing in the car when headlights were suddenly there, and we both just pulled apart. We're just terrified that we started the car and we got out of there very quickly. In his apartment, which is really a studio, we would have to put the mattress of the bed on the floor. But even though we knew that it was forbidden fruit, I think of that near with the greatest fondness. I think of him as this very, very, very special person to me. But that following summer, the summer of 54, I was home, and mother and daddy were doing lots of summer things. We were having a great summer. But Jim was writing to me practically every day. So I would wait for the mail, and I was sitting in a tall back chair in the living room reading his latest letter, and this beautiful handwriting. He became an expert on opera and an authority on opera, and had something called the Opera Companion that he wrote. He was a wonderful writer. So I was reading this beautiful letter from him and came to the last page, and at the very bottom it said, "I love you, Jim." And suddenly, behind the chair, I heard a gasp. I turned around, and there was my mother. She had been standing behind the chair, quietly reading the letter, without my knowing it. Well, then all hell broke loose. And my father came home that night. My friends came by and said, "Do you want to go down and have some ice cream at the ice cream parlor?" And so I went, just glad to be out of the house. And my father was a pharmacist, and he came, walked home from the pharmacy in this small town. And then when I came back, I walked up on the front porch and looked through the living room window. There was my father. I'll never forget. He was leaning forward, just looking absolutely desolate. And I walked in, and we sat in the living room. Mother was just tearing, just in the terror. And Daddy just looked so sad. And I t- toward the end of the evening, I said, I'm not going to leave him. That's the first thing they were saying. Mother said, you have to leave him. This is wrong. I said, I'm not going to leave him. I said, I believe you fall in love like this just once in your life. As it turned out, I was right. So the next, I went into my bedroom and Daddy came in and put his hand on my forehead. He said, it's just that we love you so much. The following morning at breakfast, I was still sitting in that breakfast room. I was still just, I just said, no, I'm not going to give him up. And then Mother pulled out her big ace in the hole. She said, in so many words, you either give him up or I'm going to kill myself. And Dad, I looked over at Daddy, and he just looked at her like as if to say, that's not fair. And I went into the bathroom and stood at the sink just bawling, because I knew that they had me over a barrel. I went into the kitchen and said, all right, I'll write him. And Mother, I remember Mother said, I'm just shaking. And so I wrote Jim and called it off. It was the hardest letter, hardest thing I've ever done in my life. Well, next to the hardest. But I returned to San Francisco State University. I was getting such good training there with Jules Irving and all. And I saw Jim occasionally. And I had dated girls all through high school. And I loved to dance. But I fed the stereotype of the gay man, good dancing and giving good parties all the time. And to this day, I do that. But back at San Francisco State, I just tried to avoid him as much as I could. But I started dating again. Even got engaged to a wonderful, wonderful young woman. Trying to fix myself, put this square punk into a round hole. And
I was just wondering how difficult it was for you in that time when you felt and other people made you feel that you were quote unquote mentally ill and you were trying to heal yourself without any support.
I could see what reputation my uncle had. And the other person in town, just whispers and all that. And so I knew I didn't want that. So I knew that I was going to... I had had a wonderful childhood, wonderful parents, lots of love, wonderful community. I had an extremely happy childhood. And I liked the idea. I wanted to be a father. I loved children. And I wanted the American dream, and this is what's so satisfying to see young gays today, that they can get married and they can adopt children or they can have surrogate mothers. All of that, none of that was possible, except unless you began living a lie, and tried to reach this dream. Achieve this dream by just playing a game.
Did you have any relief whatsoever in the artistic community in that time?
Oh yes, all through high school and all through college. But then I graduated went back to Humboldt, went to school in Mexico City for a semester to learn Spanish, and then went to back to Humboldt State. I graduated and with all of my childhood friends, many of my childhood friends in 1956, went into the Navy. Last week we talked about that.
Yes.
And my conscious objector trying to become a CEO. But all the while, you never knew when you were going to. I didn't have any. I'd act on my sexuality in the Navy. I was too scared, fortunately, because it wasn't long after I was honorably discharged that a number of the guys who were gay in the unit where I was were burned out, or whatever you want to say, and were all given dishonorable discharges. And you can't imagine what that would do to your life, what it would have done to my life, to my career in the future, with that, loans, I mean, business, I mean, all the whole dishonorable discharge for that reason would have just set so many of those young men back in so many ways. It would have been true of me, but I missed that. Thank heaven. Then I returned and to my hometown, and I had met a woman whom I liked very, very much.
And this would have been what year when you returned your
hometown? That was 1959. And she was just a lovely person, beautiful, fun, and very, very intelligent, much smarter than I ever was. And she was a great cook. She loved domestic arts. I just knew that she would be a marvelous mother and a marvelous mate. So I had to convince myself that I was going to be able to make this work.
Without her knowledge.
And it was because, you're right, because I was too afraid to bring this up. And I didn't. And many people would say, probably half behind my back, or maybe a time or two to my face, how could you do this to her? Well, this is what happened. I fell in love. And then I was physically attracted to her, very beautiful, beautiful skin. And I, as the weeks passed, I felt, you know what? I began to hear about bisexuality. I began to think that I could have the dream I wanted, of a happy marriage, of children at home, and everything that I had grown up with, that I had seen denied my uncle and so many others, but that I was going to be able to avoid that because I was feeling physically attracted. I was in love. I proposed marriage. She accepted. We were in having dinner with my parents in San Francisco at Coit Tower. The Shadows was the restaurant, and I asked her to go with me to the Coit Tower, and in the shadow of that tower, in fact, inside the tower, I proposed marriage. Then started the more courtship and all, and I was, the wedding was planned in our home church, this lovely timbered sanctuary where I had Methodist church, where I had grown up, become Methodist Youth Fellowship president, and we were planning the ceremony, and I was just feeling just on top of the world. Then about the invitations were out to hundreds of people. Then about 2 weeks before the wedding ceremony, something happened, and I shan't share it. It's just too personal. It might be too hurtful. But something happened that absolutely set me back on my heels, and within hours of that event, the house of cards that turned out began to crumble. And I realized then that what I had built up in my mind and physically in every way was shattered. And so then, for the next 2 weeks, I lived in absolute terror of what I was feeling. But And rather than become honest about it and calling off the wedding, I decided that I would, if it was as bad as I suspected it was going to be on the honeymoon and so on, that I would kill myself.
Ladies and gentlemen, we will continue the story of Lynn Pryor and the story of the Gilbert, because both are one and the same at this point. So please stay tuned for next week. Thank you.